invite you to turn with me to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. And this is a familiar verse, but we'll read from verse 15. Joshua 24, verse 15. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Now, let me walk you through Joshua and Judges very quickly. We start off with the Joshua generation. This is the generation that saw God do miracles. They saw God part the Jordan River when it was at flood stage, and they literally walked across on the riverbed and it was dry. This is the generation that saw the walls of Jericho come down. Joshua had led the people. They had, and Joshua had fought the enemy his whole life. Now at the end of his life, he is exerting his influence to future generations, and he makes this commitment. As for me and my house, or my descendants, or my future generations, we will serve the Lord. Now, when we go into the book of Judges, realize that Judges covers about 300 years, but immediately upon the death of the Joshua generation, we have a second generation. Now, the Joshua generation knew God. The second generation knew about God. Now, they were elders. They were the judges. They respected their heritage, but they lacked the commitment of the previous generation. Second generation Christians don't normally seek first the kingdom of God. Now, they are good, moral people, and they have a tremendous respect for the past generation, but they maybe have never been born again themselves. They're characterized by stability, but not necessarily by commitment or vision. For the second generation, religion is compartmentalized. It's something we do on Sunday morning, and we may do it out of respect for the previous generation. And so religion and church is a part of our life, but it is a separate compartment. Now, what happens is people whose faith is based on the coattail of someone else. Notice what happens in Judges chapter 2. There arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they went after other gods. Now, what happens across the book of Judges is there was revivals. There were returns to God, but gradually, as we get to the end of the book, we have probably the most famous statement out of Judges, in which everyone did what was right in their own eyes. You had situational ethics. There were no absolute values. There was no commitment to God, but simply a commitment to themselves. And so do you see the pattern? The first generation experienced God. The second generation heard about God. And the third generation follows other gods. And so this is a concern as we think long term. This is a typical pattern that repeats itself. Commitment, compromise, and conflict. What America needs more than anything is a recommitment to God. commitment to the faith of our fathers. Now, in this service, this is an attempt to have an influence and set a course that goes beyond one generation. Alan and Heather have decided to follow Jesus. You have, haven't you? All right, I've just put you on record. You know the old chorus we used to sing, I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. But what about the next generation? What will happen in this service is that they are publicly entering into a covenant agreement with God to raise the next generation as Christians. Now, you see, this is more than just three people. It's more than just the Burden family. But all of us are asking this same question. How do we raise godly children in a sinful world? In a world, in a culture that basically is going after other gods, how do we raise children who have decided to follow Jesus and experience God in their life? And so let me say that first of all, our children must see Jesus in us. We have to live like Christians in front of them. Our children need to hear us pray. And our children also need to hear us say, I'm sorry. Our children need training. And the familiar verse out of Proverbs is, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Let me talk to you about how you train a child. You say, well, I don't have a graduate degree in child psychology or in elementary education. But let me talk to you about how we train by see, a parent is the first teacher that a new life has, and in this process, there is an introduction. We introduce our children to things that will stay with them the rest of their life, for better or for worse. Aramaic is a cognate language to Hebrew. It's in the same family of Oriental languages. In Aramaic, the verb train carries this picture of touching the palate. Now, let's say that you're trying to wean a child. In those days, in that culture, they would often take dates, maybe some other fruit. The mother would actually chew that fruit up. Then she would reach in and get her own saliva that had that sweet taste from the dates. And she would touch the baby's lips. The baby would begin to lick its lips. The baby would say, that tastes pretty good. I believe I like that. Do you realize that that's what it means to train a child? It means you have introduced that child to a taste that in most cases will stay with them for the rest of their life. And so parenting has this idea of initiation. Whatever a child develops a taste for, whatever is norm in that child's, in other words, whatever is norm in your family environment will be the standard of normality in many cases throughout life. What I'm going to share with you now, to me, is a little bit scary, but it is said that 40% of a child's personality, 40% of a child's thought patterns is developed before they reach the age of two. And a second 40% is developed through ages 2 to 6. To the degree that that statistic is reliable, what we're saying is by the time a child is 6 years old, he or she is about 80% formed as far as direction, as far as what is normal, as far as what they have a taste for. Now, this always reminds me of my first pastor, Larry Perez, was a member of my church in Western Kansas, and he was part of our Hispanic community. And Larry told me what it was like to grow up in Western Kansas. Before he could ever walk, he said he would crawl as a baby out to the jalapeno plant. He would reach up and pick a jalapeno and take a bite of it. If it wasn't hot enough, he'd toss it aside and keep picking jalapenos until he found one that was hot enough. Now, some of you are shuddering, and if some of you accidentally ate a jalapeno, you would think that we'd have to take you to ER to have your stomach popped. But as a baby, Larry developed, that was normal for him. You may not like jalapenos, you see, but as a baby, that's what his palate was touched by. And he could eat and tolerate hot peppers before he ever learned to walk. See, that was normal for him. All I'm saying is what we introduce our children to will stay with them for better or for worse the rest of their life. Now, if they're introduced into dysfunction, if they're introduced into tension, you know, they may be undergoing therapy the rest of their life, but you never completely get away from what your first exposure is. And so I'm just saying that our parents, as parents, we must expose and introduce our children to Jesus. Secondly, we must worship Jesus with our children. We don't send our children to church, we bring our children to church. And Jesus demanded that all the little children should be brought to him. He said, allow. The King James says suffer. It means allow the little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven. If Jesus was here today, Jesus would want to hug and touch and bless every child in this congregation. You know, last week I was talking to us about our concept of God. If that's not your concept of Jesus, start reprogramming the way you think about Jesus. I promise you that if Jesus was here today, the most important people in this congregation would not be the most well-educated. It would not necessarily be those who had the most wealth or influence. It would be the little children. And so I have the privilege later, as his representative, to bless Mackenzie, and by extension, to bless all of the children. Her parents will publicly dedicate her back to God. And you are not simply innocent bystanders. You're not simply an audience. You serve a legal role as witnesses in this covenant ceremony. In some traditions, there's also the place for godparents. Godparents stand in with parents as sponsors, as a guarantee of the fulfillment that of the promises that parents made if anything would happen to the parents. In the unlikely event that anything would happen to Alan and Heather, do you realize that a part of this sacred agreement we're making this morning is that we as a congregation would step in and do everything in our power to pick up the slack for the agreement that they have made with God? You remember the title of Hillary's famous book a number of years ago, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. Let me just tweak that title a little bit. It takes a congregation to raise a child. And we look after each other. We as a congregation have a responsibility. And I know you do it. We have a responsibility to watch over all of our underage children. We have a responsibility to be the advocate for those who have handicaps or infirmities, for those who, through no fault of their own, may never reach the level of adult responsibility. They, in a sense, are also our children, and we as a congregation are to be their advocates. And in a general sense, we're to watch over each other, we're to pray for each other, and we're to serve each other through our spiritual gifts. In a real sense, this goes beyond just the pastor and my role, but the leaders of this church, the Sunday school teachers, the nursery attendants, the youth leaders are touching and blessing our children each week. And you all do in ministry. The people who take the rotation in the nursery, you are doing ministry. And we're doing this because of our covenant responsibility. Now, what I'm saying is, our children need to see Jesus in us. We must introduce our children to Jesus. Our children need to worship Jesus with us. But ultimately, our children will not always be children. And our children have to come to a point of personal decision when they, too, decide to follow Jesus. They have to decide that this is the way they want. Now, in the meantime, and to use legal terminology, a child who is a minor, that doesn't mean they're a coal miner. I pastored coal miners in West Virginia, but it just means a child is not of age. Parents have the legal authority to enter into a covenant or a binding agreement on behalf of minor children. Therefore, it's proper for Alan and Heather to act as Mackenzie's legal guardian. In this case, they as the parents are making a covenant. To use the more familiar term, they are entering into a contract with God on behalf of Mackenzie. It's interesting, these contracts throughout the Bible were always ratified by some sign or seal. Under the old Mosaic covenant, every boy child was brought to the temple on the eighth day to be circumcised. And that was the outward sign that they were under this covenant. You see, they didn't willfully, the baby didn't look, the eight-year-old baby didn't look up at his parents and say, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I want you to take me to the temple and enter into a covenant on my behalf. You see, the child is not cognizant. The child has not come to a moral, volitional choice. But the parents have that legal prerogative to make the choice for them. Now, according to Colossians chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, under the new covenant, the sign and seal has been expanded. No longer is it relegated to Jewish baby boys, but now it is relegated to all baby boys and all baby girls, because now baptism has replaced circumcision. Now, there are those within the Christian culture who object. Now, for about half of you, perhaps, this is something you've seen done all your life. For others of you, you're not quite sure about it. Just as a matter of full disclosure, I had never seen a baby baptized in my life until I did it myself. And I did it myself because through the study of the Scripture, I came to understand that this was the sign and seal of the covenant. Now, there are those who disagree, and let me be very clear, you have a right to think for yourself. Protestants hold to the doctrine of private interpretation. That means we don't just take someone's thinking without doing it ourselves. Now, you understand what I'm saying. because we believe in the right of private interpretation. No two of us agree on some things, it doesn't seem like. But still, these are such important things, we can't have someone else pontificating for us. And I respect the opinion of those who disagree. Now, hear me carefully, we should never split the Church of Jesus Christ over such secondary issues. Now, earlier in this service, when we recited the Apostles' Creed, we said we believed in the Holy Catholic Church. Now, people come to me periodically and say, I'm not sure what that means. Part of what that means is there is one universal church. Everyone who has saving faith in Jesus Christ is a part of that church. And because we believe in the unity of the church, we do not split that unity over secondary issues with which we disagree. Having said that, I feel just a little bit of a necessity to explain then why we're doing it. I'm not debating Christians of other viewpoints here, and I'm not refuting Christians who of good conscience don't do it our way. But we better understand why we do it. And so let me say, we have always affirmed infant baptism, first of all, because we believe infant children are actually saved. And secondly, because Jesus has declared them to be actual members of His kingdom. And thirdly, because the apostles baptized entire households, not only the father and the mother, but the children, by virtue of a decision the parents had made. And so let me explain this as quickly as I can. Now, the stewards are telling me that I only have 20 minutes, but I think that this far into the service, I can do it. And by the way, this is an inside joke, but they're trying to tell me that because we took the carpet up, I need to hold my preaching down to 20 minutes. I've not connected the dots on that, but I'm far enough into the message, I'm going to start the clock right now, and I think I can be done before my 20 minutes are up. Now, think with me. As my teacher said in grade school, put on your thinking caps. God warned Adam in the day he ate of the forbidden fruit, what would happen? He would die. Did he? Well, he died covenantally. He died because of a broken relationship with God, but he did not die physically because God had a contingency plan. And to put it in the simplest terms I can put it in, the atonement was already a done deal in the mind of God before Jesus ever came to earth. The reason Adam and Eve were able to take the next breath after they ate the forbidden fruit is because God already had a contingent plan. Even though Adam was our legal head, and even though he implicated all of us into his sin, Jesus is the second man. In 1 Corinthians 15, it refers to Jesus as the second man. Well, you say there's a lot of men between Adam and Jesus. No, really, they were just all knockoffs of Adam. You just had Adam all over again. Generation after generation, it was just Adam all over again. The second man who came was Jesus. And Jesus, as the head of our new race, also made a legal agreement for us. He chose life collectively for us, and through His merits, through His atoning work, before it was done, everybody was conditionally allowed to continue to live. After it was done, everyone is conditionally saved until they grow up to to a point where they willfully reject it and walk out from under that umbrella of grace. Now think about it, we're talking about almost a proxy situation. Adam acted as our proxy and got us into a terrible mess. Jesus acted as our proxy and has contingently got us grace. Now, do you realize what Alan and Heather are doing is acting also in a proxy capacity? They're making a decision for Mackenzie until she has time, until she comes of sufficient age and spiritual maturity that she can either confirm or reject that decision. The theology of this is that everyone is saved until they choose to walk away from it. And because of those reasons, that's why we baptize infants who have made no conscious choice of their own. To me, those are convincing reasons. Are they convincing to you, Alan and Heather? All right, let's do it. Bring Mackenzie up here, please.